please join me in welcoming Governor George Ryan.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you. Thanks very much. Thank you, please. Thank you. Thanks very much, Professor, for that kind introduction. I want to thank Dean Hurd and certainly Chancellor Cantor for hosting us here today. I thank you for the invite and for your dedication to developing the life of the mind here at the law school. A few people I'd like to recognize I see in the crowd today is Roger Plumer, a trustee from the university. Where'd Roger go? He was here a minute ago. Well, I saw Roger earlier. He was here. I'll vouch for it. I see my friend Sam Gove is here. I haven't seen Sam. Nice to see you. Sam has been around for a long time and kind of a fixture here at the university and certainly in Springfield with his political advice and counsel. Sam, it's good to see you. Larry Marshall, who's here from Northwestern University and heads up the school up of the wrongful convictions at Northwestern, has been a strong and powerful advocate for death penalty reform and has done a great job. And he's been a mentor and helped educate me on a lot of things. Welcome, please, Larry Marshall. I want to thank the students who've come out here today and the professors as well. I think this is kind of a proud day for the students of the University of Illinois Law School. Not only are they taking the time out from their pressures of final exams and planning for the holidays, today they can see some hope for the future. My deputy governor for criminal justice and public safety, Mr. Matt Bettenhausen, was here, so I can get up and leave. Where's Matt? Right here in front. Matt is a product of the law school here at the University of Illinois. He graduated in 1985. Not only did he graduate, but he's gainfully employed. And that can happen to some of you if you're not careful. The best life you got is right here on the campus. But in all seriousness, Matt has played a key role as a lawyer and, more importantly, a policy advisor on serious issues of criminal justice. I don't know what job could be a greater challenge to a lawyer than working on reviewing and reforming the entire capital punishment system. And to the future lawyers and to the judges and professors in this room today, the people who will make a difference in the future, I say welcome. These are exciting times for a law student interested in criminal justice. We're examining major issues of fairness and justice. And in October, the Illinois Prison Review Board wrapped up more than 2 weeks of clemency hearings for about 140 death row inmates, requesting their sentences to be commuted from death to life without parole. These hearings are the culmination of a review of the capital punishment system in Illinois that began for me in January of the year 2000. Back then, for the 13th time since 1977, a death row inmate was cleared by the courts and released from death row. They were found to have been wrongfully convicted. We had 13 innocent people, 13 innocent men, frankly, that came very, very close to being put on death row for crimes the court said that they did not commit. In one case, a man came within 2 days of being executed. The clemency hearings were not for the squeamish, I might add. Raw emotions of surviving family members were on display, and you probably all saw it on television and read about it in the newspapers. No one wanted to see the families or the victims go through any more pain. But the law left us little choice after prosecutors demanded that we have the hearings. Because the family members of murder victims wanted to express their concerns directly to me, I met with them, all of them, in a private meeting last week in Chicago, and in the week before that in Springfield. And without question, every single one of the murders are horrendous crimes, and there's no question about it. They're grisly, painful, and they're tragic. Left behind are loved ones who will forever have a hole in their hearts, and I think we all understand that. All murders are tragic and unnecessary. But we've had some murders that are truly horrible. We had a case where a mother was killed and a baby was ripped from her womb. In that case, and in at least one other, children saw their parents killed. In other cases, children were tortured. In one case, innocent motorists were brutally killed along a highway. But my review of the capital punishment system in Illinois over the past 3 years is not about how bad and how horrendous and how heinous the crime is or the nature of the crimes that have been committed. That's not what it's about, as bad as it is. My review is of the mistakes made in the system that put innocent people on death row and nearly put them in the execution chamber. I would guess there's only one thing worse than losing someone you love to murder, and that would be to wrongfully convict and execute an innocent person. That causes just double the pain for everybody that's involved. And so we are reviewing every case. And I have to tell you that I never thought I'd be standing before you here today to speak about such a difficult topic. I never planned on being involved in the capital punishment system. Capital punishment, to me, was something that I thought of only in the abstract. It was kind of out here. I was more concerned about other things as I ran for governor and as I grew up. I was from a small community about 40 miles away from Chicago, but it was a million miles away in terms of lifestyle. Kankakee, Illinois is still a small Midwestern town. It was also the home of the Ryan Family Pharmacies, where my brother and my father and I made a living as pharmacists. And I didn't think much about capital punishment. When we did, it was because we heard of some horrible crime or some notorious crime, some terrible crime, and we wanted the police to find the bad guy, lock him up, and throw the key away, and if the crime was bad enough, give them the chair for what they did. That was even all the better. Years later, in 1977, I was a legislator in the Illinois General Assembly in the House, and I voted to reinstate the death penalty in Illinois. And as I cast my vote, I vividly remember an opponent of the capital punishment system that stood up and said, "Those of you that are voting green today, how many of you would be willing to throw the switch?" That was a pretty sobering thought. I thought about it and said to myself, I don't want to be the executioner. I don't want to kill anybody, but I think it has to be done. And so I supported putting the tough-on-crime law back on the books, like a lot of legislators. The death penalty was pretty popular in those days, and it's still pretty politically popular today. And I think the 9/11 situation has even increased its popularity some. But more than two decades later, on September of 98, I was busy campaigning for the office of governor. And just 2 days before he was to be scheduled to die or to be executed, the Illinois Supreme Court temporarily stayed the execution of a man named Anthony Porter. And the court allowed time for a hearing. He was being represented by Northwestern University Center on Wrongful Convictions, headed by Professor Larry Marshall, who, as I told you, is a man that I respect for his zeal and his dedication to the cause of justice. He was trying to save Anthony Porter's life by arguing that with an IQ of 51, he wasn't mentally fit to be executed. He really couldn't understand even why he was tried. Mr. Porter was sentenced to die for a double murder in a park on the south side of Chicago in August of 1982. He was someone who probably was a nuisance to the police, and I would guess he was one of the usual suspects in a lot of the crime that happened in the area. Police witnesses saw him commit the double crime, at least that's what they said, and he went to death row, and he spent 16 years on death row. Mr. Porter had ordered his last meal and had been fitted for his burial suit. Yet, at the 11th hour, the court granted a delay so that a hearing could be held with regards to his competency. In the meantime, Larry Marshall and his group and some journalism students at Northwestern University began looking into Mr. Porter's case. And the delay gave them new hope that they could uncover evidence in proving his innocence. They had a great teacher, a journalism professor by the name of David Protest, another man that I've come to know and respect as a powerful advocate for justice. The students teamed up with a private investigator, a fellow by the name of Paul Cialino, and they tracked down the eyewitnesses who would help convict Mr. Porter. That witness recanted his testimony, and the case against Mr. Porter began to fall apart. other witnesses recanted. The mother of one of the victims, who had said for some time that she believed that Anthony Porter was innocent, was finally heard. The trail led to a man named All Story Simon in Milwaukee. The private investigator obtained a videotape confession from Simon that he and not Mr. Porter had killed a couple in the park in Chicago in 1982. And Simon admitted that he killed them in an argument over some drug money. I might add, just this week, Simon is now saying that his videotape confession was coerced by the private eye and by the journalism students. And not only did Simon confess on videotape, but his ex-wife was ready to testify against him. His lawyer saved his life by negotiating a plea bargain in which Simon accepted a 37-year sentence for the same double murder for which Mr. Porter had been sentenced to die. So much for equal justice. One man gets sentenced for murder gets sentenced to life. Another man gets for the same murder, gets sentenced to 37 years in jail. That's a broken system. I think all of it proves that, once again, how bad and how broken the system really is. Mr. Porter was freed in February of 1999. Now, just weeks earlier, I had taken the oath of office as the governor, and I was pretty upset by the news, frankly. Everything that I had believed in about the criminal justice system was now coming into question with the botched conviction of Mr. Porter. My question is, I guess, what if those journalism students hadn't taken up Mr. Porter's case, and what if they hadn't uncovered the false testimony or found the real killer? I couldn't tell you whether Mr. Porter's case was an aberration or whether it was the norm, but we almost executed an innocent person. And I didn't have a lot of time to think about that, because in the same month as Porter's celebrated case, the Illinois Supreme Court vacated the conviction of Stephen Smith, saying that his conviction in 1985 for murdering a person hinged on a drug-addicted witness. Smith was the 11th death row inmate to be released since 1977. And then came the first case where I had to decide if someone should be executed. I had to decide if convicted murderer Andrew Korkialis would live or whether he would die. He had been convicted of a monstrous, unspeakable crime. He was part of a gang that kidnapped young women, pulled them off the street, murdered them, raped them, tortured them, and killed them, and threw them back out on the streets again. There were multiple victims, but he was specifically convicted and condemned to die for the murdering of a young suburban woman in 1982. And family members of the 21-year-old victim, Lori Ann Borowski, came forward, and they shared their painful stories with the public to see to it that the killer of their child was executed. Local elected officials from Lori's community joined in the call for the execution of Andrew Korkialis. At the same time, Korkialis supporters came forward. Lawyers claimed that while he was a murderer, he was innocent in this particular case. Religious leaders appealed to me to spare his life on moral grounds. And although I had never really doubted his guilt before, after seeing what happened in the Porter case and others, I began an extensive review of the Korkialis case file. There were many unanswered questions, and I learned some new things about our court system. Rather than resolving issues with frequency, they frequently apply procedural rules to dismiss claims as waived or forfeited. Some might call these technicalities. I pored over the Prison Review Board notes from the reports on the trial and the conviction. I called in people from both sides, prosecutors and defenders, people that knew the law and understood it and been involved in it. And I asked them to review the case file on Andrew Korkialis and to give me their opinion. I talked to prosecutors and investigators. I got to tell you that I agonized over that case for about 3 weeks. But after the thorough review, there was no doubt in my mind of the guilt and the fairness of his trial, and I made the right decision. But it was a concern about the system that bothered me the most. It was a system that I believed in. And although I made the right decision based on the facts, I felt even less certain about the system of justice that put that decision in my hands. As was pointed out, I'm a pharmacist who had the good fortune to be elected governor. And now suddenly, I shouldered the responsibility and the burden of making a decision about whether to kill a person. So instead of filling orders for life-saving drugs in my drugstore, my job now as governor was to decide whether injections of lethal poison should be given to people ordered to die by the state and by the courts, a punishment that was authorized by the Illinois General Assembly. It was, in fact, a punishment that I voted for myself. Should they live or should they die? Governors have the last word. It's without question the most difficult decision any governor can face that has to face it. In the spring of 99, as we finished a legislative session in Springfield, Cook County prosecutors dropped charges against a man named Ronald Jones while they were preparing to retry him. He'd spent 8 years on death row, and now DNA tests exonerated him of the rape and murder for which he had been sentenced to die. He was the 12th person freed from death row. That summer, I signed into law the Capital Litigation Fund. I think that's one of the positive things that emerged from Anthony Porter's case. It provides funds for the defense and prosecution of capital cases. I think it was $10 million, and we went through it pretty fast. But I question whether it was enough. By now, most people concerned with this issue of justice know the findings made by a Chicago newspaper in November of 1999. There was some groundbreaking reporting that went on by Steve Mills and Ken Armstrong of the Chicago Tribune. And they found that nearly half of the 300 capital cases in Illinois, 50%, mind you, had been reversed for new trial or resentencing. Nearly 50%. I got to tell you, I couldn't fill prescriptions with a 50% accuracy. I don't know of anybody in business that could operate at a 50% accuracy. And why our courts and our judicial system and our system of justice should operate at that rate astounds me. 33 of the death row inmates were represented at trial by an attorney who had later been disbarred or at some point suspended from the practice of law. And I might add, during our hearings in Chicago, we had a lawyer that represented some death row inmate there in the clemency hearings who fell asleep while his case was being heard. We've got it on tape. Those are lawyers that we wouldn't hire for a traffic ticket. And of the death row inmates, 35 were African-American defendants who had been convicted or condemned to die by all-white juries. More than two-thirds of the inmates on death row are African-American. 46 inmates were convicted on the basis of testimony from jailhouse snitches. I'm not a lawyer, but I don't think you need to be one to be appalled by those numbers and those statistics. Our sad arithmetic continued. We had two more exonerations and two more examples of a failing system. By January of 2000, we had 13 death row inmates exonerated, and the 13th death row inmate named Steve Manning. Now, he was no angel. Steve Manning was an ex-cop implicated in some other crimes and facing prison time for an unrelated charge in Missouri. But a judge ruled that he'd been sentenced to die in Illinois based on the testimony of one jailhouse informant, one of the most notorious and unreliable forms of evidence. If you're going to put a man to death, it better be based on something more than the testimony of a jailhouse snitch. We now had more people exonerated from death row than the 12 we had executed. It was like flipping a coin. 50%, do they live or do they die? Heads or tails? We exonerate 13, we execute 12. That's a pretty bad system. I want to know, is that justice when we send innocent people to die? Not once, not twice, 13 times we did that in this state. And these are cases where the accused were convicted by a jury beyond a reasonable doubt. And their convictions were upheld in the appellate courts, and some even went as high as the Supreme Court, the United States Supreme Court. Three innocent men were saved not by judicial review, but by 20-year-old journalism students. Mr. Porter's story was not the first time that Northwestern University students saved an innocent man's life. In the case of the Ford Heights Four in Cook County, four men were convicted and two sent to death row on the basis of coerced testimony by a poor African-American teenager named Paula Gray. I spoke at Northwestern University a few weeks ago, and Paula was there, and she sat in the front row. She kind of sat like this. She'd been so deprived in her life that she didn't really know what was going on, despite the fact that she lived in Chicago for her whole life, 17 years at the time she was arrested. She had never seen Lake Michigan. She couldn't read, she couldn't write, and she couldn't tell time. She was deemed mentally challenged from her earliest days in grade school. Years later, journalism students once again and lawyers for the Ford Heights Four proved they were innocent, and they got statements from informants who admitted they lied. They found that Paula Gray, they found her, and she told them how her testimony had been coerced, first by police who had held a gun to her head, and later by prosecutors who told her that she could get out of jail free if she testified against her former friends. She did that. The information then led to DNA tests, which freed all four individuals. They were absolutely innocent, and the DNA test pointed to the real killers, one of whom committed another crime while still out on the streets. 20 years later, after every one of the Ford Heights Four was found innocent, the Cook County State's Attorney's Office went to the appellate court to argue that the 50-year perjury conviction of Paula Gray should stand. She was picked up and arrested when she was 17. At 37, they're back after her again, saying that she should stay in jail for 50 years. The judge threw the case out of the court. The state's attorney filed an appeal. I pardoned her that day at Northwestern University. When she perjured herself, when the policeman's gun was held to her head, and she was told that she wouldn't be assaulted if she, that she would be assaulted if she didn't implicate her friends. Was it when her conscience made her come clean to a grand jury and she told the panel her statements had been coerced and absolutely false? Or was it when she was offered freedom after more than 8 hellish years and serving in time in prison? She was separated from her family and frequently assaulted by other inmates. That's a nightmare. Well, we finally put an end to it, as I said last month when I pardoned her. The justice system may have wanted to continue this torment on this poor woman, but I don't know why. It was an absolute outrage. As students and as future lawyers, you ought to share in that outrage. People without means frequently don't stand a chance in our justice system. If you haven't got some money, if you haven't got some way to pay, you're probably going to go to jail if you can't hire the attorneys that you need. So I really did the only thing I could do when I called a halt to the executions in Illinois. I couldn't imagine how our system had become so flawed. I couldn't comprehend how the justice system, in which I had so much confidence earlier in my life, could prove to be so fraught with error. It was chilling that we could come so close to the ultimate nightmare. And I said that until I can be sure that everyone sentenced to death in Illinois is truly guilty, until I can be sure with moral certainty that no innocent man or woman is going to face a lethal injection, no one will meet that fate on my watch. And I think I'm going to be able to live up to that. I've got about 22 days left. Nobody will be executed as long as I'm governor. I meant it then, and I mean it now. And over the past 3 years, I've learned more about cases that were a combination of all the problems. Rolando Cruz and Alex Hernandez were twice convicted and sentenced to death row. They were nearly convicted a third time in DuPage County, Illinois. They were accused of a terrible crime, the rape and murder of little Janine Nicarico. The theory of the prosecution changed for each trial. New evidence and witnesses appeared from nowhere. Jailhouse informants were used against Cruz and Hernandez. And like Porter, they were the type of the guys who were a nuisance to the police. Now jailhouse informants could help put him away. There was no physical evidence linking them to the crime, no confession, just the alleged statement of a dream in which Mr. Cruz supposedly shared details of the crime with investigators. And later, as you all know, DNA evidence cleared both Cruz and Hernandez. And finally, the case completely collapsed when a police officer admitted that he gave false testimony regarding the existence of a so-called dream statement in which Cruz allegedly discussed a dream and revealed details of the murder only a killer would know. Cruz and Hernandez were eventually freed. DNA evidence conclusively points to another convicted child killer who has offered to confess at this minute. He sits in jail saying, "I did the crime, and I will write and sign a confession if you promise not to put me on death row." And they won't take the deal because they still think that this man is innocent. DNA has proven him guilty. Dugan, is that his name? Name is Dugan. If you can imagine that, the prosecutors still say, "We want Cruz and Hernandez." And to this date, Dugan has not been charged for that murder. Over the past 3 years, I've studied the case of another man exonerated, a fellow by the name of Gary Gauger. Gary's a wonderful, good-hearted guy. I've met him several times. Imagine this nightmare, if you will. He found his parents dead in their rural McHenry County farm. His father ran a motorcycle repair shop there. Their throats were slit. The sheriff's investigators in McHenry County very quickly zeroed in on Gary Gauger as a suspect. They questioned him as a witness without a lawyer for more than 18 hours, all day and all night, after he had experienced the shock of finding his parents dead with their throats slit. And after hours of questioning, investigators encouraged Gauger to hypothetically talk about how he could have killed his parents. And Gary said he must have blacked out because he couldn't have done such a thing. But the investigators led him to make a vision kind of statement of how it could have happened anyway. These statements were never committed to writing, and no physical evidence was ever presented linking Gary to the crime. Nonetheless, he was quickly convicted and summarily sentenced to die. He spent more than 9 months on death row and more than 30 months in prison. But Gary Gauger was innocent. But you don't have to just take his word for it. An appellate court ruled that the so-called confession was not obtained properly. Without the confession, Gauger was freed. But the prosecutors still said publicly that he was the real killer, a statement that was finally proved false a few years later. The Federal Bureau of Alcohol and Tobacco and Firearms was investigating the outlaw motorcycle gang on an unrelated case in Wisconsin. And gang members were caught on tape by an undercover agent bragging about how they had killed the Gauger couple and how their son had been convicted and had taken the rap for the crime they committed. Imagine spending one day on death row accused of killing your parents when you knew you were innocent for a crime you didn't commit. Imagine being falsely accused of killing your parents. There's another case on my desk involving the murder of a young woman in Oak Park named Karen Ann Phillips. A young man named Stephen Liscott approached the Oak Park police to help. His friends had urged him to share with investigators a dream that he had about a similar incident and a similar murder. So investigators quickly zeroed in on him as the suspect, and the Illinois Appellate Court, 10 years later, reversed the conviction, ruling that the prosecutors invented the blood evidence that was used to convince him. Three men, three statements described as visions or dreams that were used against them, wrongfully convicted. But the only vision they saw was of a justice system run amok, of their dreams being dashed and ruined by the criminal justice system. Thankfully, all three men are freed today. But they have requested pardons because their records still have the stain of their arrest and their conviction. And that is until right now. Because as governor with the constitutional powers that are vested in me, I am right now pardoning Rolando Cruz, Gary Gauger, and Stephen Linscott for their crimes. All three. Thank you. All three of these men have done their best to rebuild their lives. I don't think anybody can imagine what they've been through, what it's like to find work, to get paid, to live some kind of a decent life with this kind of a stain on your record, a false accusation, a false conviction, a false everything, and almost be put to death. I wish them well. They've been through hell. After I declared the moratorium on the death penalty, I appointed 14 very dedicated people to serve on the commission to review the system from top to bottom. And it was chaired by former federal judge Frank McGar and was co-chaired by former Senator Paul Simon and former U.S. Attorney for the Northern District of Illinois, Tom Sullivan. My friend and Deputy Governor Matt Bettenhausen was a member of the commission, and he was also the executive director. And they came up with 85 recommendations to improve the caliber of justice in the capital punishment system in Illinois. They called for police and prosecutors to share more evidence. The number of eligibility factors for the death penalty should be dramatically reduced. The interrogation process should be videotaped. Lineup procedures should be changed. Lineups should be done sequentially to prevent bias or confusion. The panel recommended a statewide standard for capital punishment. A statewide review committee should review death penalty eligible cases before they go to trial. And it would drastically limit the use of jailhouse informants. The commission's reforms right now are languishing in Springfield in the state capitol. We talked to a lot of parties in putting together our recommendations, and we met with citizens and lawyers that represent different perspectives, including that of law enforcement. And on the eve of the clemency hearings, we had a full court campaign of criticism against our efforts to review these cases. In the October 14th New York Times, the state's attorney said, if there's a fair trial, the appeals were handled appropriately, and that's what we should be looking at, not some reforms that you come up with 15 years later. I would suppose as long as journalism students, college professors, and committed private investigators keep dedicating themselves to investigating cases on death row, we should be fine. Perhaps that is someone's idea of a system that works, but I find no such responsibilities spelled out for those students or private eyes in my copy of the state and federal constitutions. My intentions are pretty simple. I'm not trying to kill terrible killers and put them back on the streets at all, and I certainly don't want to punish the victims, the families. I think somehow they feel that they have a right to have restitution or to have resolve and finalization to their problem. And execution is the only way that's going to happen. And I certainly don't want to execute an innocent person, and that's really what it's all about. And over the past 3 years, I've always said that there's enough blame to go around for everybody, prosecutors, defense lawyers, police officers, judges, and even the Illinois General Assembly. But it's a great disappointment to me that forces aligned against the reform have banded together and stopped my efforts to pass a bill that reforms our capital punishment system. The General Assembly did, however, find the time to pass a law and override my veto so that they could expand our broken death penalty system even further. They now have an added extra eligibility factor, that of death for the crime of terrorism. And I suppose there's no harm done in such grandstanding, because if Osama bin Laden is caught, I can guarantee you that he won't be tried in Champaign Circuit County Court. But I guess it's the principle of the thing that we're concerned about, and the principle seems to be something in short supply when it comes to move from talking about reform to actually making reforms a reality. And instead of rolling up our sleeves and working together, as all of us should be, the governors, the legislators, the lawyers, the police officials, the prosecutors, and the judges, we instead have experienced delays and distortion and detours on the road to a more perfect justice system. If, in fact, we're going to have the death penalty, and we do, then we ought to make it as perfect as possible. Will it ever be 100%? No. But it can certainly be much better than it is now, because it's only 50% or less. And these reforms are needed to bring that death penalty up to the standards that we can live with. At the clemency hearings, Terry Hoyt, a mother of a murder victim in Decatur, Illinois, said the man that was sent to death row for the murder of her daughter should probably be pardoned. You probably don't see a lot of news coverage on that, at least I haven't. She believed that a fellow by the name of Montel Johnson, who claims he was innocent, did not kill her daughter, especially because a co-defendant agreed to a plea bargain of 15 years in turn for testimony against Johnson. And two of the convicted killers in the same case are now on the streets, and Montel Johnson sits on death row. The mother courageously testified, if you're going to do justice like that, then let Montel go. Truer words were never spoken, and we shouldn't do justice like that. So I leave the students and the faculty of this law school with this. Soon I'm going to be leaving office, and our talk today will only be a memory. And my ability to reform the criminal justice system is going to be limited, although I'll preach from every pulpit every chance I get. But you're here today to offer hope for the future. Remember that the law is bigger than any man or woman. And remember that America is at its finest when the justice system seeks to be a shining beacon of fairness and justice. And remember, most of all, that as lawyers, you should be engaged in a passionate search for the truth instead of a relentless quest for courtroom victories. And too often, it's like a sporting event. It's us against them. It's we must win at any cost. And we have to be very careful about that because that's one of the big flaws in the system. The victories notched on your gun belt will someday wear away. But the scars on the justice system will live on in the lives left in the furrows that will never heal. I thank you for the opportunity to be here and share my story with you. I thank you for your attention. I wish you all a very Merry Christmas and the best for your future. Thank you very much. Too long.
Thank you so much for your thought-provoking comments and remarkable announcement this morning. The governor has graciously agreed to take questions. In the spirit of the academic engagement in which this event is intended, I ask that the questions remain focused on the issue of the death penalty at hand. We do have four students with cordless microphones that will be going around, and I ask that you wait until you're presented with the mic so that the folks in the overflow room can hear the questions. Yes, sir.
I have two questions for the governor whose actions in this area I appreciate, and also Mr. Marshall and Professor Portis at Northwestern University. I think have done this state an invaluable job. The two questions are this. One, if we can never have the system which you've said, which is perfect, that means we are going to be executing innocent people. Therefore, should we not abolish the system, and should you not send a signal by commuting all of the sentences of the people who are?
Well, certainly. You have more?
Yeah. The other question is, touching on something that you emphasized, why are there not severe criminal penalties for prosecutors and police officers who so corrupt the system, who lie, who hide evidence, who plant evidence. Shouldn't these people be in prison?
Certainly. I would think that would be a good project for the law school to undertake and forward the information on to the General Assembly. No question about the last half of your question. That's right. Blanket commutation and the abolishment of the death penalty. I read a book by Governor Brown that his daughter sent to me about 3 weeks ago when he was governor of the state. He went in as governor as a prosecutor. He believed in the death penalty and in the system and believed that it worked until he became governor and had to make the decisions about life and death and who got the penalty. And he turned around completely. And knowing that he couldn't pass in the General Assembly a bill to abolish the death penalty, he introduced it anyway. And it failed to get out of a committee in the Senate in California by one vote. It was an 8-7 vote against it. But he brought attention to it. This was back in the late 50s, early 60s when he was governor. But the thing that I think that we need to do, abolishment is probably in the future, maybe a long ways down the future. But we have to keep the discussion alive. We have to make people understand that the ability to kill people through government orders and laws is something that has to be handled very carefully if, in fact, we're going to have it. I agree. We can't have a perfect system, so it probably should be abolished. If I could do it, I'd do it today. I'd abolish it. But that can't happen. But again, these young lawyers and young students that are here for the law can certainly get involved and be active in a process that makes those changes in the General Assembly, and that's what it's going to take. That's a process I'm going through right now, and the press has been after me pretty heavy to give an answer on that. And the folks that I've met with, the families, there's one thing that I'm somewhat disturbed about, and that's that I think most people that are family victim members feel it is their right to have death as a penalty. And I'm not sure why that is, whether that's a culture that we have here in America, but they claim the only way that they can get closure on the issue is to kill the person that killed their loved one. And they believe that, and I'm not critical of it. I just think that it's kind of a wrong situation. Now, there are 12 states, or 13, 12? In the United States that don't have the death penalty. And we've talked to people there, family members, and they said the finality is that we know what's going to happen. We don't have to worry about what's going to happen. We know they're going to be commuted to life in prison forever, and we don't have to worry about the death penalty. And, of course, there's a growing movement for people that are just victims against the death penalty. So that started to move around the country some. It's an educational process that people have to go through, and I think that we've at least put the spotlight on it, and we're going to continue to work with it. And guys like Larry Marsh and David Protess and the folks that have been involved in these movements all around the country have made a big impact on the whole program. Yes.
Hi. I have one question, and that is with regard to the next legislature. Do you think, or what's your hope for whether they'll follow your proposals in making reforms for the death penalty?
Well, the governor-elect tells me that he's going to keep the moratorium on. I can't tell you for how long. I'm sure there'll be pressure for him to release it. The complexion of the Illinois General Assembly has changed. The Senate won't be as conservative as it was under the Republican leadership, and there could be the possibility of some real changes there. I've had an opportunity to discuss with the new leader of the Senate, Emile Jones, the new president, the possibility of some reforms in the system that we now have and in the reforms that we put in. And with any luck, we might be able to get those through, or at least some of them. But, it politically is a popular thing to be for the death penalty. And people go back in most of their districts and come back and say it's a 60, 50, 60, 70% issue, and we don't want to vote against it. We want to be for it. Re-election is the biggest conflict of all in the whole system, so that's what it's about.
You said
Dean? Let me interrupt a minute. I see John Cribbett is here, the former dean. Where are you, John? There he is back here. Thanks for being here.
What did I do now?
If you were a politician, you'd give a speech. I don't know about ex-professors, what they do, or former deans. No, we're not going to touch that one, but thanks for being here. Who's next?
You said earlier in the beginning of your speech that all murders are tragic and unnecessary. With that belief, isn't that enough to go through with the blanket commutation and stop state-run murders, if they truly are tragic and unnecessary?
Well, I would guess that you may be right, but I got to be somewhat practical in this situation, and that's what I'm trying to be, and I'm trying to be fair. And as I said, the victims' families have very strong emotion and feelings about the finality for their lives, and I have to consider those things, and I'm going to do that. And hopefully, I'll make the right decision before I leave. I've got some 25 days left, and I'll do it before I leave, but I'll do what I think is right.
Steve. I use this in my class. It doesn't work for me either. The terrorism component that was just passed over your veto leads me to conclude that we still have the tough on crime, weak on crime dilemma, at least in our state. I'm sure we have it all over the country. From your experience as a legislator and now as governor, how do we ever get fair on crime as the proper focus for our elected officials?
Well, first of all, practically speaking, the terrorist bill that expanded the death penalty for terrorists in Illinois came at a time when there was an election and a candidate for office that thought that the popularity of the death penalty, and of course with the problems that we've had with terrorists, that was a good measure to put in, and it passed overwhelmingly, frankly. And I mandatorily vetoed that bill and put in my 85 reforms in addition to that. I thought it was pretty clever, frankly, but the General Assembly overrode that veto in pretty good fashion. And but the feeling was that it was a campaign issue for some of the candidates, and it was an issue that got tied up in the politics of the time, and that's why I think it passed so overwhelmingly. But you're right. We have to have those reforms, and I think the best time would be to do them is as far away from an election as you can. It's like raising taxes. You do that early, not often, but early.
Governor Ryan, there is one thing in the entire discussion that always seems to be snowed under, and that's that the death penalty doesn't stop with the death row inmate himself, the punishment for the crime he or she committed. I've worked with family members of death row prisoners whose children are being scorned at school, whose family members are being evicted out of their homes, whose wives find their houses broken into, landscaping smashed, tires slashed, who are scorned for life and scarred for life by what a family member on death row has done. This is another issue that should be brought into light, because the murder victim families, with all due respect, are not the only family who have suffered, but the family members from prisoners who have made or have committed these horrendous crimes, they suffer as well, and they also suffer for life, especially their children, the ones that I work with. And they are scarred so much for life that it would be good, maybe, if you can, Governor Ryan, to consider making a statement that you also have sympathy for those families and not only for the families of the actual murder victim families.
I'm aware of that, and I appreciate your comment on it. I've been requested to meet with those families of the victims of the families that are on death row, of the prisoners that are on death row. I don't know if I'm going to have time to do that, but I'm certainly sympathetic to their cause. And you're absolutely right. Their parents, their fathers, their mothers, their sisters, their brothers that love their relatives and have suffered greatly at the thought and the anguish that maybe they wake up the next day and their loved one's going to be executed. And for 15, 20 years, people on death row have to live with that. It's got to be a miserable existence and a lot of punishment, I might add. And it's even worse if you're guilty, or if you're not guilty, I mean.
You touched on this briefly in your speech about apparent racial bias in some of the sentencing for death penalties. I was wondering what findings your committee found to compensate for that.
We did find the racial disparity in the system.
Do I find? Yeah, I think the whole system is racist. I don't think there's any question about it. The biggest majority of people on death row are racist. It's, as I said, if you haven't got any money and you're poor, you're in trouble. If you're charged with a crime, you don't have much of a chance. And you look at the things today, the cost of attorneys. Am I not answering the right question?
Well, in terms of what the commission found.
This guy's been dying to get up here.
Yeah.
In terms of what the commission found, we specifically looked at all first-degree murder cases in the state of Illinois, and there was a finding that there is a geographic and racial disparity in the imposition of the death penalty in the state of Illinois. In terms of the recommendations that would help to address that issue and try to take the disparity out of the system or the chance for discrimination was a statewide review commission that would look at it so that you don't have 102 different decision-makers deciding whether it's going to be a death penalty case, but one panel, and that was one of the many recommendations that we had made. Part of the governor's legislative package was also to take away police officers' licensings if they had committed perjury. So that again, the General Assembly didn't pass that. Well, of course, they can be prosecuted for perjury as well, and those cases need to be prosecuted. Now I'm happy.
Okay, all right.
Governor, I haven't heard you mentioned the cost of the death penalty. Does that come into play at all here, and have you considered that?
Well, I've often said that we're not talking about dollars. We're talking about life and death. So I find it difficult to put a dollar cost on it, although I'm told that to keep a person on death row is much costlier than putting them on in life in prison without parole. It's cheaper to do that. I don't have the numbers. I don't know whether my able aid has them or not. Doesn't have the numbers.
What good is he?
But I think that it's true that it costs more money for prisoners to be on death row. Thanks to all of you again for your time. Have a Merry Christmas.